Welcome to the First Things podcast. In this episode, we'll talk about Mother Teresa, whose canonization is this Sunday. Why is her service to the poor so much more inspiring to the religious and the irreligious than the more effective altruism of secular humanitarians? Then on to the beaches of France, where the burkini is turning heads. What does this very modest garment reveal about French identity? Must religious believers go naked in the French public square? Finally, we'll look back on a classic work of literature that contains a falsified prediction about saints named Teresa. First Things editor Rusty Reno and literary editor Matthew Schmitz join me on this episode. I'm associate editor Julia Yost. Thanks for listening. On Sunday, September 4th, Mother Teresa of Calcutta will be canonized Saint Teresa of Calcutta. The diminutive Albanian nun who died in 1997 established orphanages, soup kitchens, and homes for the dying, and founded the Missionaries of Charity, an order of sisters who give wholehearted free service to the poorest of the poor. Since her death, two miracles have been credited to her, enabling her canonization. Alas that the man who played devil's advocate in her cause, the voluble Christopher Hitchens, is not alive to see the happy day. Alas, too, for the late Malcolm Muggeridge, another British journalist whose star-making book and documentary about Mother Teresa back in 1971 established our image of her. I quote, "Something of God's universal love has rubbed off on Mother Teresa, giving her homely features a noticeable luminosity. This love, this Christian love, which shines down on the misery we make and into our dark hearts that make it, irradiating all, uniting all, making of all one stupendous harmony," unquote. Mother Teresa won the 1979 Nobel Peace Prize. She was and remains one of the most admired women in the world. She commands the admiration, even the piety, of people of any religion and no religion, give or take a few missionary atheists. For most folks, she embodies charity, philanthropy, altruism, humanitarianism, whatever you want to call it, at the highest level. Rusty and Matthew, could you comment on the appeal of Mother Teresa? I'm struck by the breadth of her popularity, given that she was, in fact, an extremely, nay, fanatically, Catholic figure, and was not an especially effective humanitarian by our accustomed standards. So why is she felt to be a saint for everyone and not just hardcore Catholics?
Well, I think people recognize that how difficult it is to escape from the prison of the ego and to encounter someone who seems to have effected that great escape is, I think, just very arresting for all of us. And I think that's what she exemplified. And of course, what people found so, well, many secular people found hard to digest was the very straightforward Christian claim that only in obedience to God can you really make that escape. So the ability to love your neighbor as yourself is a consequence of self-abandonment to God. And it can't really be effective without the divine orientation. So I think it's pretty straightforward. You know, there are very, very, very few people who escape the prison of the ego.
Right, so if I'm an effective altruist who thinks that I should do the most I can to reduce suffering as much as possible, I might compare Mother Teresa negatively to people like Bill and Melinda Gates, who have done more on a global scale to relieve suffering than Mother Teresa has. So I would make that rational calculation that they have done more good than Mother Teresa and admire them more, but that's not how our intuitions work. We admire this person who's able to actually embrace ugliness, make sacrifices that touch her very personally and immediately. That's what attracts our admiration more than this kind of effort to, you know, do the most good. So I think of Father Damien of Molokai, a man who left Belgium to live among the lepers in Hawaii and actually caught leprosy himself and died among them. He was attacked by, you know, other religious humanitarians at his time, you know, the kind of Presbyterian ministers who lived in Honolulu on Baratania Street said that he didn't actually do that much to introduce rational reforms or concrete improvements in the lives of the lepers. They said that he himself was narrow and bigoted, that he was slovenly, and they attacked him for this. And when these attacks started to appear in the press, Robert Louis Stevenson, who had visited Father Damien's colony, was furious. And he wrote this letter condemning the men who had played devil's advocate against Father Damien. And what he said in that letter, I think, is true of Mother Teresa. He said, "The one reform needful was to go there and by one overwhelming act draw the attention of the whole world to the suffering of these people. That was the one reform needed." And that's what Mother Teresa did for the poor in Calcutta.
She explicitly rejected criteria of effectiveness in her ministry, because her ministry was not, it was a ministry of grace, not a ministry of utility. And it was a ministry to serve the nuns' needs and not just the needs of the poor. And so for our own spiritual well-being, we need to, the corporal works of mercy provide an opportunity to escape, back to my theme, to escape from the self. And so the poor were not objects of her charity, but opportunities for love.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in that connection, Rusty, I know you've read Simon Lays's book, The Hall of Uselessness, and he has a wonderful essay in there. It's a really review of Christopher Hitchens's attack on Mother Teresa. And in that review, he tells a story from, you know, Indian literature about these monks, and they start a little clinic at this place where they're praying. And people begin to flood this clinic, and the monks who were once praying are now spending all their time tending the wounds of the poor and suffering. And this head guru, this man of great wisdom and holiness, shuts down the clinic and sends away all of the sick who are coming. And this confuses his disciples, and he says, "Well, it's because we had ceased to pray." And so, you know, surely, you know, we can do both. But, you know, with that story, kind of dramatize the interest that Mother Teresa certainly had, as you say, Rusty, in, you know, tending to the lives of the nuns as well as those of the sufferers.
I guess I just wonder whether the Nobel Prize Committee understood how otherworldly her priorities were. I mean, these are ideas that scandalize nobody in this room, but to a generation that thinks in terms of effective altruism.
Yeah, right. It's almost an anti-Mother Teresa concept.
Exactly.
Effective altruism.
Yeah.
Well, there's a way in which, you know, Mammon's not maybe not the right way to think of it, but there's a sense in which, for the modern person, it's really all up to us. And I think for a Christian, at the end of the day, things are in God's hands. And so ultimately the question of effectiveness is secondary, not primary. But if you don't believe in God and you don't think there's a providential hand in human affairs, then everything really does fall to us. And then effectiveness becomes the number one criterion by which to judge things. I think that's I think that that's a kind of a hopeless position to be in, since we're doomed to ultimately be ineffective. Suffering and death are not going to be cured, no matter how effective our philanthropy is. So it's not an argument, I'm not trying to make an argument against, you know, doing things in a prudent, wise way, but it's just that mentality, if it gains the upper hand, I think, can actually be demoralizing and paradoxically make us less likely to make the endeavor.
I mean, I've heard it said that for the effective altruist, you know, the best life is the one in which you work really hard. You work 75 hours a week at your dreadful, soul-killing job and make as much money as you can, and you just give it all away. Right. And this seems, okay, that's, you're getting bang for your buck, I suppose, in a philanthropic way, but you're also killing your soul. So it's just a very different way of going about doing good works. But I wanted to offer a critique that Christopher Hitchens made and just see sort of what you think about this.
I disagree with what he said. I don't know what it is, but I'm just going to say that.
So what was the thrust of his critique?
You know, so he is asking roughly the question that I asked at the beginning of this segment, which is sort of, hasn't anyone noticed how weird and just not an ordinary secular-style humanitarian Mother Teresa is? Why do we talk about her as though she were actually effective at relieving suffering, et cetera? And he has one explanation in which we can see his Marxist attitudes. He says, "The rich part of our world has a poor conscience, and it is no fault of an Albanian nun that so many otherwise contented people should decide to live vicariously through what they imagine to be her charity." So in other words, the wealthy West wants to believe that someone somewhere is helping the poor so that they don't have to, and they sort of participate in her efforts either by donating money to her order or more often just by forming a really high opinion of her. Because she's helping the poor on their behalf. And I think Mother Teresa becomes less useful as an icon, less useful as a balm for our consciences, once her work ceases to be recognizable to us as helpful and effective philanthropy. And so this is one of the reasons why so many people who are not on board with her dogmatic commitments, and certainly probably not with the way in which her dogmatic commitments shaped her work, so many people nevertheless revere her and maybe don't appreciate or just don't want to know the degree to which her work was actually quite weird by their standards.
So how deaf do you have to be?
I'm not sure I grasp the criticism.
Right. Well, so his criticism is that Mother Teresa...
They're falsifying her work in order to have a good opinion of her, in order to feel better about themselves.
Right. Well, that just seems like a kind of Christopher Hitchens saying, well, if human beings were not self-deceived, then they wouldn't do these stupid things.
False consciousness.
But that just requires people not to be human. I mean, it's human to be attracted to things that you don't fully understand. It's also human to be hypocritical. And there's certainly a strong element of that, right? You write your check to send to you know, the Sisters of Charity in Calcutta. That is the name of the order, isn't it?
I have a stronger criticism of what Hitchens has to say. I mean, how deaf do you have to be to think that Mother Teresa was trying to solve the conscience of the West? This is a woman who went to the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., and said before, President Bill and then First Lady Hillary Clinton, that abortion was the greatest threat to peace in our time because it pits the mother against the child and makes her the murderer of the child. This is a woman who, in the acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize, issued similarly withering condemnations of the complacency of the rich world. I mean, this is it's a very, very lazy argument from Hitchens, and
It isn't, because yet the Clintons will tell you, oh, Mother Teresa, she's wonderful. I have nothing against Mother Teresa.
That's also what the BJP, the Hindu Nationalist Party, eventually had to say, even though they initially opposed her. Her prestige was so great they had to pretend to accept her.
I think you're right, Julia, that we have, I think that's just human nature. People recognize the charism of charity as a genuine charism. And that's not charity as in terms of doing effective things, but to be present to those in need. And they recognize that in her and they admire it, even though they themselves have no capacity to actually follow her in her footsteps. Or they discount her anti-abortion language as, well, you know, she's Catholic, and so she's been brainwashed on these matters, and we progressive people know better. So there's all kinds of ways in which you can, I don't see that as a bad thing. I would rather have a world where people use excuses and are self-deceived, but still see and acknowledge the light of sanctity, than to have a world where people are more perfectly consistent and therefore deny sanctity because it's inconsistent with the other things that they can't give up in life.
What I think is true, though, is that many people who profess to admire Mother Teresa do not appreciate how profoundly she challenged us. I think that when the Clintons say they admire Mother Teresa, they're not lying. They don't see any important difference between their values and Mother Teresa's. And a lot of Mother Teresa's admirers feel the same way, which seems crazy if you actually understand what Mother Teresa actually thought and did, which I think a lot of people don't want to, because that makes her disturbing rather than comforting. There is a real and stubborn ignorance about just how different her purposes and methods were from those of effective altruists. So she becomes the Catholic Gates Foundation. I think a lot of people, most people, prefer to think of her that way.
I see your point. And you know, it's the same thing with the kind of, you get gauzy image of Jesus, you know,
It's kitsch.
He's the good shepherd. He's the, you know, he's the smiling, affirming figure.
Right. And so I think that in a similar way, I think Mother Teresa has been kitschified. And so that is disappointing to people who do in fact care about Mother Teresa full spectrum.
Sure. But I don't think that was Christopher Hitchens's
concern. No, it's definitely not.
Well, at the end of the day, religion is the opium of the masses for him. So, you know, religiosity is always a screen for something, whether it's the screen that we project our self-deceptions onto, in the case of her, or whether she uses it as a screen to project her own self-deceptions. So
Christopher Hitchens was not making my point, but right. I can appropriate his point for my purposes. This is what I'm doing.
Please avoid appropriation, Julia.
Late in a turbulent summer in France, after terror attacks in Nice and Normandy, many municipalities, especially along the Mediterranean, have interested themselves in how Muslim women clothe themselves on the beach. The burkini sounds like a punchline, a hybrid that shouldn't exist. It's a portmanteau of burqa and bikini, a full-body bathing suit designed to accord with Islamic standards of modest dress. This August, many French towns have moved to disallow it. Cannes was the first. Nice and others followed soon after. Tickets have been issued, citing the failure of offenders to wear outfits consistent with, quote, good morals and secularism. The mayor of Nice called the wearing of the burkini an unacceptable provocation after the terror attack in that town. The prime minister of France called the burkini the expression of a political project, a counter-society, based notably on the enslavement of women. Now, critics of the burkini ban argue that it's kind of odd to say you're liberating Muslim women by pushing them around and ordering them to take their clothes off in public. The burkini ban might also be a tad Islamophobic. Rustine Matthew.
Oh, I hate that word, Islamophobic.
Sorry. Anyway, Rustine Matthew, if you were mayor of a French town with a beachfront, what would you do about the burkini?
Well, the French are in a difficult position, because they have their official, you know, they're inheritors of the French Revolution, which is really about the rights of man, all men. So it's hard for them to assert that they have a distinctive culture that they want to preserve. No, they're the universal culture, the culture of the rights of man. But obviously in their confrontation with Islam, it's a confrontation of French culture and Islamic culture. And so it puts them in a hard place. So that's why it's so incoherent, the burkini ban. But I think if I was a French mayor, I would embrace the incoherence. And here's my thinking. It's a little convoluted, but it's very interesting. If you look at data on on anti-Islamic sentiments, they are higher in the multicultural countries of the officially multicultural countries of the Netherlands and Sweden than they are in France. France has a long history of public conflict over religious Islamic religious symbols. They've banned headscarves, they've banned the veil, and so on. So this follows in a tradition where the whole clothing issue becomes part of a proxy war over French identity. And French attitudes towards Islam are more favorable than the Dutch that have this official multicultural policy. And so it suggests that when the French see their political leaders defending their culture, they're actually more hospitable towards Muslims than when they fear that their political leaders are betraying them. So in an odd way, this kind of gesture may actually do more good for Muslim, non-Muslim relations in France than inaction.
I see these mayors as caught between two kind of escalating ways of talking about our political problems. One is this language of secularism that views all religions as the same, and so these mayors have said, well, of course, if we're going to ban the burkinis, we couldn't let women dress as nuns out on the beach either. And so they try to maintain this superficial
neutrality
mm-hmm. when in fact there's only one thing that is being targeted and is a real problem. There's only one thing that represents a true counter-society, as Manuel Valls put it. And then on the other hand, you have people who are mocking these bans and rejecting them using the language of religious liberty and of rights to say that these bans are, of course, totally unthinkable, deeply wrong, deeply evil.
Well, they're struck down by one of the high courts
France. They've been struck
week.
Down by a court.
Some of the mayors are saying we're going to find a way to impose it anyway.
Right. So I'm not scandalized by the bans. I'm not confident they'll do a great deal to help. But I think the burqa is an evil garment. I think it does express a hatred for women's body. It locates modesty on the flesh of the woman altogether instead of in the eyes of the man, which is the lesson that Jesus teaches in the Gospels. I'm not reluctant to see French society fight against the most perverse form of a false faith, which is this Salafism represented by the niqab and the attempt to cover every inch of a woman's body.
But the issue at stake here really has to do, and the French recognize it has to do with the public space, that a society is defined by how its public space is articulated. Whether it's the public buildings and the architecture we use for them, or the way in which we interact with each other in the public square. And one of the great problems of secularism is that it doesn't have a public form. I mean, secularism is a nakedness, which is really funny that when Richard John Neuhaus founded the magazine, he was inveighing against the naked public square. And here we have a political battle in France that is insisting on pretty close to nakedness for women as a way of expressing identity. And that you're in a bad situation when absence is your primary identity marker instead of some kind of presence. And I think that Pierre Manent has argued, and as I said, if I was a French mayor, I would support the burkini for this kind of counterintuitive judgment that it might actually promote reassure the French that their society is being defended by, and they could be more hospitable towards the other. But Manent has argued, and I think it's right, that the long-term issue is to repopulate French public space with Christianity, which has a capacity to be capacious and it has a place and a role for Islam. Secularism doesn't have a place or a role for corporate religious identities.
Yeah, it seems very unclear in this debate what about France is being defended by the burkini ban. So Marine Le Pen, who's president of the National Front, which is an anti-immigration party, wrote in a blog post that supports the Burkini ban, "This is the soul of France that is in question. France does not lock away a woman's body. France does not hide half of its population under the fallacious and hateful pretext that the other half fears it will be tempted." What is the soul of France that's talked about
so
here exactly?
There's an equivocation going on between secularism and Christianity.
Exactly.
And so we can look at the, a painting, Liberty Leading the People, with the uncovered bosom of this woman. Now, one French politician, I can't recall his name, said, this is the symbol of France. Her bosom is uncovered because she is feeding the nation. She is nursing us with liberty. Now, this is really close to Bernard of Clairvaux, who we can see an icon kneeling before the Blessed Virgin, with an uncovered breast is feeding him with her milk. And so, it's really the same kind of French idea appearing in different guises, different centuries. I prefer Mary to
Lady Liberty.
Lady Liberty.
But it matters,
and I think
right?
that maybe the French are going to have to choose between those.
Right, and it
matters.
Well,
this
is
a problem with freedom as your central value.
Right.
Freedom for what? Freedom for the sake of freedom becomes a sort of self-defeating circular definition. So back to Matthew's point, I think Matthew made a really good point that Marine Le Pen really can't make up her mind whether it's the freedom of women to dress as they please or whether it's this false view of the nature. I mean, that our ability to function together in society depends upon an interior self-discipline, that you not look upon the woman with the eyes of lust, which is Jesus' teaching. And that, so therefore, our civility as a society is not because we regulate things outwardly, but because we regulate our souls inwardly. And the free society is a society of people who've achieved a degree of self-government, and that they have command of their souls, that allows us to be tolerant, open, and capacious in our how we regulate the public square. Whereas the Muslim view, at least the Salafist view, is that the public square has to be rigorously regimented and regulated to prevent vice or bad things from happening. And I think the Christian view is that the soul has to be regulated.
I think, too, that in Le Pen's comment, there's an equivocation between, France as an organ of universal human rights, so France as sort of a nation beyond nationhood,
right,
versus France as a particular nation with a particular history, which is grounded in local cultures and a religion which happens not to be Islam.
Right. Well, we Americans have the same problem.
Yeah.
Which is we're the universal nation. So I think most Americans think that the natural condition of the human person is to be American. And a friend of mine from Belgium said that's true for the French too. And I said, no. For the French, the perfection of the human person is to be French, which is actually only accessible to people who are born and raised in France. So they do have this kind of uneasy tension between France, the universal nation, and France, the perfect nation.
Which seems not irrelevant to their issues with immigration right now.
Right. So, I think that, all of Europeans, but especially the French, because they have a modern view of rights, and that when Napoleon offered citizenship to Jews, it was on the condition that they no longer identify corporately, but only as individuals in relation to the state. So it used to be that the rabbis represented Jewish interests to the French state. He dissolved that, said the state's going to relate to every citizen as an individual. And as I was saying earlier, this just makes it very difficult to deal with the corporate reality of religiosity. And this is part of the agony of the French situation. They have difficulty acknowledging that a native-born Frenchman is a distinct part of a distinct corporate reality, and they have a hard time acknowledging that Muslims in their midst are also part of a corporate reality that overlaps but is distinct from the larger French corporate reality.
So the burkini ban, giving new meaning to the naked public square.
Indeed.
I just wanted to end with that silly joke.
That is pretty funny.
Let's close with a passage from literature, which you gentlemen perhaps can guess the source of. So see whether you can name the author of this passage. This is an abridged version, FYI.
Oh, come on, if it's abridged, how can we?
There's a lot here. Who that cares much to know the history of man has not dwelt, at least briefly, on the life of Saint Teresa, has not smiled with some gentleness at the thought of the little girl walking forth one morning, hand in hand with her brother, to go and seek martyrdom in the country of the Moors. Out they toddled from rugged Avila, until domestic reality met them in the shape of uncles and turned them back from their great resolve. That child pilgrimage was a fit beginning. Teresa's passionate, ideal nature demanded an epic life. What were many-volumed romances of chivalry and the social conquests of a brilliant girl to her? Her flame quickly burned up that light fuel, and, fed from within, soared after some illimitable satisfaction, some object which would never justify weariness, which would reconcile self-despair with the rapturous consciousness of life beyond self. She found her epos in the reform of a religious order. That Spanish woman who lived 300 years ago was certainly not the last of her kind. Many Teresas have been born who found for themselves no epic life, wherein there was a constant unfolding of far resonant action. Perhaps only a life of mistakes, the offspring of a certain spiritual grandeur ill matched with the meanness of opportunity. Perhaps a tragic failure which found no sacred poet and sank unwept into oblivion. These later-born Teresas were helped by no coherent social faith, which could perform the function of knowledge for the ardently willing soul. Here and there is born a Saint Teresa, foundress of nothing, whose loving heartbeats and sobs after an unattained goodness tremble off and are dispersed among hindrances, instead of centering in some long recognizable deed.
Now, are we allowed to ask whether this is a translation of something written in another language, or whether it's...
It is not. It is English in the original.
English in the original. Okay. So I have to decide between G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc.
Hilaire Belloc?
Hilaire Belloc.
Both wrong.
Oh!
All right, so if those are out, let's go for Newman.
Nope.
No?
Okay,
what do we got?
300 years, let's see, St. Teresa was late 16th century, so someone who's...
So this author must be 19th century, right?
Right. But he's also worried about the dissolving of Ruskin.
Getting closer, but no.
Somebody worried about the dissolving of inherited social patterns of life.
I'm going to say the author's a Catholic.
The author is very definitely not Catholic. The author is George Eliot. This is The Prelude to Middlemarch.
Oh, beautiful.
How about that?
Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome. Anyway, my response to this...
But perhaps Eliot really is a Catholic.
So
we could have a first things essay on that.
I never thought about that. So this is Eliot's way of... Dorothea is...
Should have been a Teresa. Yeah.
St. Teresa, but she lacked the form in which her moral heroism and loyalty to conscience. So she was just stuck with loyalty to conscience.
She lacked the coherent social faith. She was stymied by the meanness of opportunity. I mean, that's the story of Middlemarch.
Yeah, yeah.
But my response to it has always been, George Eliot, no more St. Teresa's living epic lives. We'll see about that. We'll see about that. Just wait for the 20th century. That's it for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Matthew Schmitz. No thanks to Christopher Hitchens or George Eliot, who each got it wrong in their own ways. And thank you, listeners.